Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Guillermo Amaral joins me. We're going to be talking Pearl. We're going to be talking Pearl ORMs, Dybbuk class to be specific. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Guillermo Amaral, episode 363, recorded November 17th, 2015, Dybbuk class. This episode is brought to you by DigitalOcean, simple and fast cloud hosting built for developers. Deploy an SSD cloud server in 55 seconds. Try it today for free. Visit DigitalOcean.com, and once you sign up, be sure to enter the promo code FLOSS in the billing section for a $10 credit. And by Drobo, a family of safe and expandable yet simple-to-use storage arrays. Drobos are designed to protect your important data forever. Visit drobo.com/twit and use the code TWIT100 to save $100 off a Drobo Mini, Drobo 4-Bay, or Drobo 5N. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre, open-source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at StoneEdge.com, bringing you each week, or as often as I can, the movers, the shakers, the big projects, little projects, projects you may be using every day and totally unaware of it, projects you may want to download right after the show and go play with it. Joining me today is my frequent co-host, Guillermo Amaral. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Randall, how's it going?
Going well. And like about 20 shows ago, this is a South of the Border show. I'm actually visiting my friends here down in Tijuana, Zona Rio in particular. And I'm pointing right at you. You're just over there somewhere.
Wait, that way?
There we go.
There we go. Yeah.
Oh, that was so cute. Anyway, yeah, so great. So we have a really great guest today. We have, let me get the name correct here, Peter Rabbitson. We're going to be talking about Dybbuk class. This is a Perl show. Yay, finally a Perl show. I bet I know what his favorite scripting language is, but we'll have to ask him at the end just for the fun of it. Dybbuk class is a class of software, which are many for many languages, called an ORM, an Object Relational Manager. And you use something like this when you want to do a lot of stuff with SQL, but you don't want to have to write all the SQL by hand. You'll teach the language, like in this case Perl, what the tables are, what the relationships are, and then you basically just write code that says, give me all the rows that link to this row, and it just magically pulls those out and turns those into Perl objects. Peter knows a lot more about this than I do. Well, maybe not. No, I'm sure he knows a lot more about Dybbuk class than I do, because I'm still pretty much a youngin' in Dybbuk class. So we'll be bringing him on in a few minutes. Any observations, Guillermo, before we get going?
I'm just going to warn everybody that I'm not – I used to be a Perl guy before, but then I kind of switched into just a full-blown compiler guy. So I haven't used Perl in a while, but I'll try and do my best.
Okay, well, that's good. Well, I can certainly fill in the Perl part, and you can probably ask ORM-related questions because that's sort of a general thing. But that's great. So we'll bring them on in just a second. But first, I've got a very important message for you. Because whether you're an experienced code warrior or just getting started, you need flexible, reliable, and affordable hosting. DigitalOcean provides developers with Droplets, which are virtual private servers that can be customized and deployed quickly to host websites, web apps, production applications, personal projects, virtual desktops, and almost anything else you can think of with full root access. I myself am a DigitalOcean customer, been that way since February when I found out that they had free BSD in the cloud. That's a really rarity thing, so I'm really glad DO is doing that. Deploy and configure your Droplets via a streamlined control panel or a simple API. You can choose your OS, Ubuntu, CentOS, Debian, Fedora, CoreOS, and FreeBSD. All the servers are built on hex core machines with dedicated ECC RAM and RAID SSD storage. Servers can have up to 20 CPUs, 64 gigs of RAM, and 640 gigs of SSD hard drive space. There are auto backups and snapshots to let you easily clone, deploy, and resize Droplets as you grow. You get full-featured DNS management to easily manage your domains or use dedicated IPs. And it's so easy to get started, you can deploy an SSD cloud server in as little as 55 seconds. I have personally observed this. DigitalOcean has incredibly affordable and straightforward pricing. Servers start at only $5 a month. There's also hourly pricing available starting at less than a penny per hour. So you can get started today and deploy an SSD cloud server for free, and free is a good price. Visit DigitalOcean.com and create an account. Once you confirm your email and account information, go to the billing section and enter the promo code FLOSS for a free $10 credit. That's plenty to get started and explore what DigitalOcean can do. That's DigitalOcean.com, and once you sign up, enter the code FLOSS in the billing section for a $10 credit. And we thank DigitalOcean for their sponsorship of Floss Weekly. And now let's go ahead and bring in our guest, Peter Robinson. Welcome to the show.
Hello, guys.
Yeah, hi, and where are you speaking to us from?
Currently, I'm speaking from Germany. And from what you guys said earlier, you are this way, I think.
Okay. I don't know which way you're facing, so I can't tell if that's even close.
Trust me, you are this way. Yes.
Okay, very good. Very good. And I sort of gave what my view of DivX class is. Can you tell me a little bit about the history of DivX class and what it actually does for you in a Perl program?
Right. The history. The history of DivX class is actually pretty long. The project itself got started in 2005. It actually just celebrated like 10 years in August. Wow. But before that, it all started with Class DBI, which I think was started in 1999 by Michael Schwern. Started a lot of stuff in the Perl community, apparently. Then got taken over by Tony Bowden, and then Matt Trout came to Perl and was pretty unhappy with some of the limitations because, you know, let's face it, in 1999, we didn't really know much about... in Perl, we didn't really know how to do object orientation correctly yet. We didn't have enough best practices and things like that. Instead of breaking backwards compatibility with everything, he started a new project, which is DBX class. What does it do? If you've seen Inception, the movie, there is a thing there where they basically get into the in between creation of dreams and consuming of dreams. DBX class is not as much of an ORM in the traditional sense. It's more of a tool that lets you both generate queries and consume the result of queries. With kind of two semi-loosely related parts, which together, however, work to get together, to basically give you a full-blown ORM.
So it's as I described, I mean, you use it to access without writing SQL, although you can actually write sort of SQL in it too if you want to, right?
That's correct. So basically on the query side, when you're actually talking to the database, of course, databases these days, still relational databases, still mostly speak SQL. There are some ways to, you know, to try JSON and things like that, but mostly it is SQL the way it was back in the 70s. And it is pretty tedious to write, especially for most of the queries that you do are not very complicated. They're basically select stuff from stuff where stuff. And you write this over and over again. With a framework like DBX class, you are able to cut the middleman, so to speak, and express your code directly to express your queries in code directly. And then the ORM, the query generator part, will take care of translating this into SQL that the database will understand.
And is this a relatively efficient thing to use, or are we really adding another two layers of indirection?
We are adding two layers of indirection, of course, but it depends how are we measuring efficiency? Because in terms of development time, of course, efficiency is drastically increased, because all you're doing is basically you are just using your business logic in the language that you are normally working with. For DBX class, it's Perl. For other ORMs, it's their own host language. And you basically don't have to do the context switch. You express everything that you need through Perl, and it will do the translation for you. Now, the translation itself, of course, does incur a little bit of overhead. However, again, if you're smart about it, this overhead pretty much goes away, because DBIC allows you, DBIC is what we call DBX class for short, DBIC allows you to express more complicated queries and get more results in one shot. So where you would have 200 queries because it's too hard to write the more complicated thing by hand. With DBIC, it's going to be easier to express it. So where you had 200 queries, you actually will have only one. So in fact, you're going to get the results back faster.
And the community for DBX class seems to be pretty large. Has it been growing over time?
Yes and no. basically, in the beginning, it was with any new project, exciting, fresh. There were a lot of people really hacking on it. And then a lot of production happened. So things started slowing down a bit, and then more and more production happened. And in 10 years, DBIC got to a point where it is pretty much the ORM of choice for pretty much 99% of pro projects these days. And of course, with great production comes great responsibility in terms of backwards compatibility and what people rely on and things like that. So being able to get into the code base and change stuff substantially without affecting a massive, by this point, user base is getting more and more complicated. So unfortunately, I've witnessed people kind of starting to move away because, a patch comes in, it addresses a problem, it creates another 5 problems on its own. And the person is usually, the submitter is usually not able to spend the time and effort to clean, the corner case and things like that. Additionally, DBIC itself is very well architected in terms of pluggability, not as much on the storage layer, but on the rest of the layers, like on the SQL generation, on the result parsing, and on the object creation, things like that. It is really, really well factored out. So a lot of the new development actually happens in plugins to DBIC, not in the project itself. If that makes sense.
Hey, well, talk some more about the plugins. How would people plug things into this, and what kinds of plugins are there?
Right. So DBIC is built in Perl. We have this de facto object orientation framework these days, Moose, or its lighter version, Moo. DBIC was built before that, like about 2 years before Moose even appeared as an idea. And it uses a lot of multiple inheritance. Now, multiple inheritance, if used carelessly, can really create a lot of problems for you. But we have a bunch of helpers and parts of the framework that basically take care of mistakes for you. And a plugin is basically you have the APIs of the project itself. So, for example, you have your result set base class, which represents a query plan, so to speak. And if you want to write something that makes smarter result sets, you will simply override some of the methods that you would be interested from the public API, and or add your own methods with your own names and stuff like that. You put them into already pre-designated directory names and restart your project, and everything is picked up and everything just works.
And I think I just caught you saying that DBX class was written before Moose. Was there a transition period then where you went from the old way of doing it to the new way?
Well, it still doesn't use Moose today because, frankly, Moose as the framework, it tried to do a lot of things correctly, too many things correctly, and tried to be a little bit more opinionated than I personally consider practical. And in the process, it made a lot of decisions where the trade-off in performance was pretty dramatic. Another project, Catalyst, started a little bit before DBIC, and it did make a transition to Moose. And honestly, I think that this transition actually turned out more bad than good, because now a Catalyst project takes about 5 times as long to restart. And development type, development time, any kind of rapid prototyping where you fix a little bit and restart your application and fix a little bit again, is becoming harder and harder to do. DBIC did not switch to Moose at the time. There was actually a lot of pressure, so to speak, from, you know, from big names in the community that, oh, why doesn't this use Moose? Everything else does. But this turned out to be a very good decision, because today we have Moo, which is pretty much Moose without the Meta Object Protocol. And within DBIC, there is very little stuff that can benefit from that. So there are small pieces that I'm slowly migrating to Moo, because multiple inheritance is a little bit different than what Moo and Moose prefers to do in terms of roles and you know, and method modifiers and things like that. However, yes, little by little it is moving to Moo, but this is a work in progress today.
And I think I caught that you didn't start DBIC's class. How did you take over as the maintainer?
All right, so DBIC got started by Matt Trout originally with about five, if I remember correctly, committers that were kind of regular. And then around 2008, so 3 years after the project came about, I was working in a warehouse, just starting my programming career, trying to get you know, orders synchronized and stuff like that. So I had a mentor who knew a little bit of Perl, and this was kind of the reason I got into Perl in the first place. And then I asked pretty much everybody in you know, pretty much any IT career, programming career, sorry, writes their own templating system. I've done this, although it was a PDF. I've written my own little web framework, which luckily burned to the ground very quickly. And I half wrote my own ORM, and then I found DBIC, and I kind of fell in love with the thing. And started submitting patches, and it was pretty rough around the edges at the time. I mean, we're still talking 2008. And after about a month of throwing patches in direction of the mailing list, I ended up getting a commit bid. And then another 4 months in, I realized that everybody else moved on happily to other stuff. And I kind of, you know, got stuck with the project more or less.
And so what's it been like being the project leader for this over the years?
It's been various. On one hand, of course, yeah, it's actually a difficult question because on one hand, of course, it's amazing. It's a framework with a very long history and with a lot of expectations in terms of what people wanted to do. And these expectations on top of everything started rising more and more with the time. Like when I started originally, it was a miracle that a left join would work correctly and would fetch the stuff from the left from the right side of the join, and then put it together into neat objects. And this was considered like, wow, you know, it's actually working. And today, for example, we have people who do about 50 to 70 joins in the same statement, because programmatically it's pretty easy to just keep tacking them on. And they complain when it doesn't work, you know, quick enough, and, you know, expectations shifted. So the project is, of course, very interesting. It is dependent upon by a huge, huge portion of the Perl ecosystem. Also, and not very many people know this, it is probably, I haven't actually run the numbers on MetaCPAN because it's the API does not really make it easy, but I think it is the project with the most individual contributors, like distinct contributors. We have 212 of them at this point. Like basically you can check the commit history of you know, stuff coming from different people. Now, this is the good part. No, exciting, awesome. Job prospects are, of course, not that big of a problem. The bad part is that I get exposed to a lot more of kind of what ails Perl these days in terms of people depend on something, people want stability, and especially from a database layer, they want double the stability because this is their data. And if something goes wrong and you find out about it like 2 weeks later and everybody has backups, as we know, it might be pretty tough. Whereas if it's a web framework or if it's an object orientation framework, if it stops, your production stops right away, you kind of know right then and there, right? So this clashed with seeing how kind of the community does not really move forward in terms of picking up the responsibility, so to speak. And in the past several years, my job kind of as a primary developer is mostly to refuse patches because this and this will break and never to hear from people again. Of course, that's probably a failing on my side because I probably am not encouraging enough when I do my refusals, but you know, I try to get better. So it's been up and down, I guess.
Cool. So I have done projects for people like Insight Cruise, is one of my longtime clients. And we started with CDBI. And then I saw the announcement that, is it Tony that took it over? Tony Bowden? No.
That's right. Yes, Tony. Yes, Tony
okay.
Bowden.
I remember reading the statement on the man page that said, there is a community around CDBI and I'm not part of it. And I thought, no, that's pretty... you know, like, you know, screw you community. And so I thought I'd have to move to something new. And originally, DivX class was sort of trying to maintain backward compatibility. And there were a lot of the parts of the interface that I didn't like about CDBI. And so I switched over to RoseDB, thinking that it's not only faster, but it's also got an interface that I can really live with. How would you contrast RoseDB, which I still use and know intimately, with DivX class? Are they trying to solve the same problems, similar problems?
They're solving almost the same problem. The approach is different. So with Rose, what John Siracusa, the developer of RoseDB, the direction in which he went was, I will define an API. It will be as versatile as anything that I currently have access to, which he did a brilliant job at. In fact, I would say the basic API of Rose is probably a little bit better than what we have in DBIC. But then everything else inside, he really, really hard-coded for speed as much as possible. So methods that are 10,000 lines long, and it's very non-extensible, and it's really fast because of that as well. If you know RoseDB intimately, you probably ran into limitations. Like, for example, if you need to do a more involved aggregate, then the answer is pretty much to define a database view. And that's it, right? Which is not really that great. In DBIC, it originally was designed for flexibility to overcome the problems that ClassDBI had in its API. Now, it did actually maintain a lot of backwards compatibility with ClassDBI, not because the ClassDBI API was saying it really good. Even in 2005, it was already kind of obvious that a lot of the ideas put in there were not really that good. Like, for example, with ClassDBI, in an application, you could have only one database connection because everything was class data, and it was really not cool. But the reason DBIC actually went with a lot of the legacy API was because of the test suite. In fact, even today, DBIC still runs, as part of its testing, still runs the original test suite of ClassDBI. I mean, it's modified here and there, of course, but this is what gave the early developers kind of a peace of mind that they're going into the right direction by basically just reusing a test suite that was already there. And so they worked on that, and the result was a system that's kind of rooted in ClassDBI that is better extensible. There was a lot of the class state was moved into instances, so you could have multiple connections, you could have multiple result sets and stuff like that. And this, of course, came at some penalty, especially in the Perl 5.8 days when multiple inheritance was not cheap at all. Later, class C3 appeared and class C3 XS appeared and things like that. And then C3 actually got merged into the Portal 5.10 release, and since then things kind of got better, but originally it was a really, really bad trade-off in terms of speed. Today, I'm actually catching up to RoseDB because a lot of the stuff settled, and there is now a lot of code inside that deals more or less in code generation, so I know what my extensibility points are, and at runtime when everything is already loaded and I know that nobody is going to load further plugins because loading plugins at runtime is not really supported anyway for other reasons, I go ahead and go through my stack and basically optimize it together either by shortcuts or by string evals and that actually write new code in place. The same way kind of like Moose does with Make Immutable. DBIC does this as well on currently on the object creation side. It doesn't yet do anything on the query generation side, but this is pretty much the next step to tackle.
Let's see. Maybe we can take a little step back and just talk about something a little bit more generic, you know, for me in this case. Could you maybe tell me what standards your application actually uses? I know there's a lot of different SQL standards out there. You know, MySQL, and you have the Postgres one. Which ones do you use, or are you just focused on a single one?
Best thing about standards is there are so many to choose from, right? There are actually two SQL standards, the original and the updated one, neither of which are supported by pretty much all RDBMS engines, which is kind of bizarre, but that's how it is. DBIC itself, when it talks to a database it doesn't know anything about, it will use sort of an amalgamation of SQLite and MySQL syntax, in a sense, I mean, just most roughly speaking. However, it does actually have subclasses on the storage subsystem for the vast majority of database systems out there, and even for some weird ones. So obviously we support SQLite, we support PostgreSQL, MySQL, those are easy. We have drivers for Firebird, we have drivers for Microsoft SQL Server, we have drivers for Oracle, we have drivers for Sybase, both ASC and ASA. We support DB2. There is also driver for Informix. There is even a subclass for DB2 on the AS400 that somebody contributed, which had just a little difference. So it's really pretty funny that you know, actually we are able to talk to all these databases. Now on the side of DBIC, there is actually not that much that we have to do because the query generation basically is the same until you get into limits. So for limits, none of the SQL standards, by the way, the official standards, have an official way to get a result set and get the middle five rows from it. There is just no such standardized things. There are extensions and stuff like that, but there isn't actually a limit M comma N keyword or anything like that. And we have support for eight different limit dialects, which are all written in, and they compose nicely. So basically you can have a result set that actually fetches data from multiple tables with multiple joins and stuff like this, and it will still apply the limit correctly and get you the correct stuff back. For other things like more expressive SQL, like for example window functions and things like that, we rely on the other side of DBIC flexibility, where we allow a lot of freeform SQL where you need it. So we do the basics with select, insert, update, and the basic wheres. We do pretty much all join expressions correctly. But for stuff that is very engine specific, like for example PostgreSQL JSON B, or I don't know, or for example some kind of Oracle windowing function, you would actually have to write just this part yourself, but it will compose with the rest of the framework just fine.
Is there some way to auto detect what server you're going to be using? Let's say if I want to use DBIC and I change my server from, okay, this is going to be a bad example, but let's say from MySQL to MariaDB, or again, bad example, but let's say Postgres, somebody changes our backend to Postgres. Would I need to do any major code changes in order to actually start using Postgres now in our web application, or will it auto detect what server it's talking to?
Right. So this is mostly the major selling point of any kind of abstraction framework for relational database access, because you can change your engine on the fly. And like most engines, DBIC will actually detect not only which engine you're talking to, but which version of it, because some of them differ in syntax that they accept, funnily enough. In addition, yes, the actual SQL syntax will change a little bit, and DBIC will accommodate for it as much as it can, as long as you didn't use literal SQL snippets, which you should try to keep to the minimum, specifically because of this. You gave an example of somebody switching from MySQL to SQLite, MySQL to Postgres. This is not a very realistic example. A much more realistic example is people who develop against a team of DBAs with very hard policies on what goes in with a huge Oracle server, and there are not enough licenses and things like that. Or, for example, they work with Microsoft SQL Server, but they don't want to run Windows on their workstation. A lot of these people actually test locally with SQLite or with Postgres SQL if they need additional features that SQLite doesn't support. And I know a lot of people who do this in production. They actually go back and forth, and when they have to use a specific syntax that is specific to a particular engine, they actually, when they define the result set, they at runtime ask the underlying storage, what are you right now? And depending on that, substitute the correct piece for this database. So it all works pretty well.
You mentioned that it auto detects even what version you're actually running right now on a server, correct? Right? Is there maybe a plugin or something to also help you, maybe warn you about potential security risks you may be having? Let's say you haven't updated your MySQL server for like 2 years or 3 years. And would it maybe warn you about that, or is that something you guys aren't really don't really care about? Not the security aspect, but I mean actually warning people about that stuff.
Within DBIC itself, that would be pretty strange, because let's face it, not everything that runs with a database is actually exposed to the internet, right? So sometimes being up to date with security is not that big of a deal. In fact, several years ago, there was an email to the mailing list from somebody local to the town here in Germany. And I did some research, because I'm like, oh, somebody here in town uses my stuff. And I did some research. They were actually using it to write a web reservation system for the laundromat at the dorm where they were staying, because they had too many sharing violations, and they basically were making a website so they can schedule who is going to do their laundry when. For something like this, being nagged about your MySQL being 2 years out of date is really not something you want to do. However, this is actually a very good idea. It never occurred to me, and this is something that very well fits into a plugin. Basically, it would be a schema, Yeah, that's right. A schema component which you would load, and then on every connect, on every reconnect, even if you are behind some kind of load balancer and some of the servers you connect to are newer versions, some of them are older versions, on every connect it will check what it's connected to, and based on the signature, so to speak, in this plugin, it will, yes, give you a warning. That's a very good idea. I'm actually writing this down for, you know.
Don't worry. You can send a check over to me. That's fine. Don't worry about it.
Yep.
So I do remember you mentioned, you know, everybody goes through creating their own ORM at some point, right? And yours seems to be extremely complete now. You have so many standards. Because, for example, in my case, I stopped at, SQLite and MySQL support in one that I wrote like a few years ago. And I never moved into like off synchronous. Is that something you guys are handling, like async transactions?
Right. Well, it's not async transactions. It's async access to the database.
Access. You're right.
Yeah, no problem. But generally, yes, the world is kind of swept by storm with async frameworks and trying to do programming under this paradigm. Async and databases are strange. Now, there are a lot of toolkits out there that do simple queries to databases in an async manner, but I have never seen anything like really complete in terms of how does it handle the hard questions. Like, for example, yes, you select something, then you update it, and all of this happens in a transaction. Now, until this transaction finishes, you cannot really start anything else anyway. So you are working serially. And you could be async by opening a whole handle to the database, which will then blow past your connection limit or will start contending for disks. So it's not a good idea in general. Also, in terms of what is the bottleneck, these days, if your database does not really answer quickly enough, your database simply isn't tuned. Almost never in my experience working on larger systems, the actual queries are the bottleneck, because the hardware is better, the tables are really well optimized, there are indexes where they should be. DBIC in general, that kind of encourages you to declare your joins in a sensible way, basically column-to-column identity, so indexes are used correctly and stuff like that. And generally, it is your business logic that is the bottleneck. Additionally, my alter ego from the Python world, Mike Beyer, the guy who writes SQL Alchemy, it's an ORM in Python, a pretty popular one as well. And he, about a year ago, wrote a pretty long article about how, given the workloads that he is dealing with and given the structure of his framework, he also doesn't see an easy, way to tack async on top of it. Nevertheless, async is interesting, and I have a standing call with pretty much all the communities that deal with this style of programming, both the IO async framework in Perl, the modulicious people who are really into async. I have an open call to them. Tell me what you actually want to see from the API. How would you interact with it in a synchronous manner, and how am I going to implement it? It's a second problem. Currently, the entire thing is kind of stuck at what do we want an async DBIC to actually look like, and so far there hasn't been any like feasible answer to this. So if you are watching and you have auto experience with concurrent programming, and you really know how DBIC can really benefit from stuff, just shoot us an email, tweet at us or whatever.
You know, you mentioned earlier the idea of having the same code run with both, say, something like SQLite for testing and MySQL or Postgres or something like that. My other big client right now is ZipRecruiter, and that's exactly what we do. We have the same test running against essentially a SIM database that we set up that loads all the things in that are sort of pretend data, and then that keeps our tests consistent, and that's exactly what we do. And because the code's all in DivX class, it makes it real easy to transfer that around. I also want to say that I sit directly across from Frew, who I'm sure you know really well, and it's great having a DivX class expert like right there that's willing to do all the stuff for me that I don't have any clue of how to do. He's written like a lot of plugins, right? It's almost every time I ask him how to do something, he pulls up a plugin that he's written in the CPAD and it to fix the thing that I'm looking at. Is there a fairly large community around creating the plugins? And I think I asked that already. Well, anyway, you can answer it again.
yes, you kind of did. And it basically slowed down because a lot of the stuff that people really wanted got written. And most of the plugins are pretty good at this point. So we have, dynamic updates, triggers that's already written. We have all kinds of deployment, managers for your DDL, for your schema changes that's already written, also by Frew, by the way. Plugins for, Frew maintains a thing where he kind of throws together a lot of his ideas that he just comes up with, and he codes it up and just puts it there. Some of them are really well done. Some of them are kind of rough around the edges, unfortunately. But that's why they're not core plugins. As far as other people writing plugins, there isn't another prolific contributor like Frew. Yes, people are doing a thing here and there, like one or two plugins all over the place. Like if you go to MetaCPAN and search for DBX class Colin stuff, you will end up with at least 200 hits.
Yeah, it's really great. I was early on, since I know Postgres way better than I know MySQL, and I was being asked to optimize MySQL code, and I kept staring at the planner, and I was going, how does this work, and all that stuff. And then we hired an actual DBA, Craig, who might be in the chat room as well, and now all I do is file a bug, and he fixes it. So when I say this query's slow, he fixes it. Same thing with most stuff that would be about DivX class. I just simply, tell Frew, hey, I need this done, and therefore it works really well that way. It's nice working with experts all the way around everything. And I know Guillermo has another question to ask, but I have an important message to bring you before we switch back to him, because digital data is the essential part of our lives. For all of your storage needs, Drobo is the simple, safe, and expandable solution. They offer a complete line of external storage arrays, which you can order preloaded with drives or add your own. Drobo's 5N is perfect for a network-attached storage or as a media server, file server, or backup solution. It's easy to use. Just plug it into your switch or router and you're ready to go. Apps let you back up data to two different cloud service providers or sync via BitTorrent sync. It includes a quad-core ARM processor. Three of these cores are available to run Linux. Tools for developers include a full LAMP stack, Node.js, and WordPress. It also supports C and C++, Go, Perl, yay Perl, Python, and Ruby, as well as Git to host your own repo. Drobos are reliable. Data received by your Drobo and not yet written to disk is protected if there's a sudden power loss. Even better, Drobos have an internal eUSB device where the data is copied if there's a power failure to protect against long outages. It's expandable. Expand or replace storage in your Drobo with ease. No tools required. Beyond RAID technology lets you expand on the fly and mix and match drives. It's also simple. It's easy to read. Colored lights on the front of the Drobo communicate this current status. It's fast. It supports Thunderbolt, Gigabit, and USB 3 connections. Connection varies per model. It has an SSD hot cache to accelerate the database and small file reads. It's also great for reading HD and large media files. I've actually been a Drobo owner for about, 8 years now. I really enjoy it. It's where all my important data goes there. I have 8 terabytes or something in there. It's really really quite cool. So visit drobo.com/twit to learn more and check out their complete line of products. And when you use the code TWIT100, you'll save $100 off the purchase of a Drobo Mini, Drobo 4-Bay, or Drobo 5N. That's drobo.com/twit and use the code TWIT100. We thank Drobo for their support of Floss Weekly. And now, Guillermo, you had a question?
Yeah, it's more of a follow-up, actually, because I do remember a case when that whole asynchronous issue with an ORM caused a little problems in a project. In this case, we had a remote server, and we couldn't really make a copy locally in that system. And you have a lot of network issues, maybe network delays and stuff like that. And even if locally you do ask for a, let's say you make a request to your server, if it's not local and you have network issues, that it'll take a long time. It'll block the application, right? So I don't know how would that be handled with a DBIC?
Right. This kind of use case where you basically have a lot of network latency, which, let's face it, when you are talking to databases, is kind of rare. You normally want your database to be right there, hot and ready. But in this case, when you need to talk to a server that is out there somewhere, then you will basically just fork a process, and DBIC is both fork and thread safe. It has really, really good handling for this. And you would fork a process and basically do the dance with IPsec between the two processes and stuff like that. It is not ideal, but if you think about it, with databases, normally async is done this way anyway. There is another process underneath that actually talks to the database, because most of the protocols are not async friendly at all. Now, some are, like, for example, the Postgres one, the MySQL one, but talking asynchronously to Oracle or to MS SQL, that's not going to work.
I didn't want to put you there on the spot, because I do know that's not usual, but it does kind of happen. Maybe if you're working with somebody with not a lot of resources, right? But I do have another question for you, though. This might be going back just a little bit more. But you did mention that you didn't like hit and run patches, and I'm sure nobody really does. But is there any way somebody could just start in the project and maybe? Maybe a mentoring process, or are you actually looking for contributors in, an active way?
I am trying to start to look for contributors again, because the project is basically in need of fresh eyes, so to speak, fresh eyes with some responsibility. We also have a lot of problem with our documentation just growing and being very, very complete, overly complete, without a good guide to where to find what. So basically, if you know a particular thing being possible, you will find this documentation just fine. But the documentation is really bad at pointing you at some piece of DBIC's existence in the first place. So actually, several months ago, I kind of made a call it was kind of presented as DBIC is hiring with the fine print that you should apply to a TPF grant for a red documentation project of DBIC, and that I would be personally available for any kind of questions, and basically I will be there to make sure that the person writing the documentation understands what they're writing about and what actually happens in the background and stuff like this. So in the proposal, it literally said unfettered access to the main developer or something like that. And there were a lot of retweets, a lot of likes. They were favorites back in the day, and zero takers. So I guess I didn't market to the right crowd. And generally, how to start with the project, there is a lot of not low-hanging, but intermediate-hanging fruit, so to speak. We have a very good test suite. We have extremely, extremely elaborate CI, turnkey CI that's pretty much continuous integration that pretty much nobody else in world space really does to the extent that we do. So getting involved is easy. You just submit a patch to which I, as usual, will give a very specific, you know, this is why this is not going to work, this is why this is a problem. And just after this initial feedback, don't run away. But, you know, plug at it. That's, I guess, my advice to somebody who really wants to start and be part of the project. Another thing is that there might be a power void soon, in a sense that I might be stepping away from DBIC next year because I kind of, not exactly I'm getting burned out, but more am getting too much at odds with other people on whom DBIC relies as, you know, as the underlying there's underlying libraries and stuff like this. We have some dependencies, of course. And I kind of made the decision that probably next year I will move to something else, try maybe another language community or something like that. It's kind of all there. But if you, you know, have been looking at DBIC and were really wondering if only it wasn't for Ribasushi and then I would get into the project, check back in January, maybe I won't be there anymore. So maybe it will be up for grabs.
Well, if you're looking for a new language, there's always C and C++, you know, just saying. No, okay. So I did have another question, though. I was looking at the commit log. And I noticed that, like, work stopped, or at least almost stopped after, I think, July 2010. Is there a reason for that?
Yes, and it's actually funny. It has nothing to do with work having stopped or anything like that. In fact, work accelerated from this point on. And you can see in a lot of other large projects around the same time, kind of the activity goes. The reason for this is that this is the time we switched to Git from SVN. This is when huge merges and huge commits of, oh, this is all wrong, and we cannot kind of like rebase it away. The rebase didn't exist as a word back then. So we have to just delete everything, put it back in. We generated huge, huge logs of changes. The actual activity increased since then a lot. And actually, if you look at amount of code lines, they keep steadily going up even since then. But a lot of large projects, when they switched to Git, they went into, oh, okay, so now we can actually write this patch. We can put these 20 commits with, oh, typo here, typo there, squash them together. We can, you know, we can have clean history. We can see easily what was put 5 years ago in relation to all the other changes that happened in the same commit, because now we're, you know, we're putting changes together and stuff like that. So it's interesting to see how, you know, a superior, let's just say superior source control tool can have such weird effects on perception that basically the project kind of died, you know, if you look at the commit history in SVN. But it's actually doing just fine.
Cool, cool. Hey, we got a question from the chat room here. Paul Franz asks, is there anything about the DivX project that you wished you could change but are afraid to change because of concerns over backward compatibility?
Good 85% of it. We don't have time to list everything. Look, you have to realize that, again, Class DBI, borrowed the test suite. A lot of considerations went in to make sure that this works. So the original class-based architecture is still there, and there are still people today who use this. In fact, there are establishments, like really, really large ones, which use Class DBI, a fork of Class DBI, and DBIC, and class DBX class CDBI compat in one project, in one runtime. We're not talking, you know, different subsystem, but actually in the same executable, they have all this stuff together and talks with each other. Uh-huh. The iterators on the result sets were a terrible idea. The way the storage layer was architected is not ideal. There are a lot of things to change there. In fact, a lot of these things are being worked on little by little, and it's just a very long, very tedious process because to way too much money at stake. And what is going to happen if we put something out that is, you know, that is just not compatible, that cannot be made to work with two or three changes in the entire project? People are going to stop upgrading. And you can work on an awesome project, which is clean, which is, you know, architected correctly, and nobody using it. Or you can, you know, just deal with what you have and improve incrementally while considering everybody's stake in the process.
Well, I have we're almost out of time, but I do have a couple, one other interesting question that you actually sent me before we started the show. What's the craziest piece of code within the framework?
Within the framework itself, the craziest piece of code is how we keep, so we have an object hierarchy for the metadata layer. So we have a schema, which knows, which is basically a single instance, which knows about the storage, which holds the DBA connection and so on and so forth, all the metadata about your server. And on the other hand, you have all the sources which describe every individual source, be it a table, a view, and so on and so forth. And this entire graph of objects needs to know about each other. Now, if you just do it the simple way, you will have circular references and you'll have memory leaks, which is really not cool. If you have only the schema referred to everything else, you have to keep the schema in your scope at all times. The moment it's garbage collected, everything else breaks. So actually, we have a system which keeps track of all the objects in a particular graph. And the moment something is about to go out of scope, it hooks the destruction on the Perl level, reattaches this object to another one which is already in scope, so it has a lot of strong references to it, and inverts the relationship between who is the weak reference and who is the strong reference, so the graph actually doesn't fall apart.
No, really?
Yeah, you're using
the same thing. That's bizarre. That is, I've heard of a lot of really weird code. I've written a lot of really weird code. That's like an order of magnitude weirder than I could ever possibly come up with. So that is, did you inherit that, or was that something you had to come up with?
This is something that I heard in passing from Matt Trout as a concept. The concept wasn't this. The concept wasn't how to write the thing itself. The concept was that you can abort a destruction of an object in Perl. And the actual implementation of this, the actual, you know, back and forth, because everybody has to be in on the deal, so to speak, for this to work. The actual implementation was entirely mine, and it took a lot of debugging actually to get it to be correct. But it has not had any changes for the past 4 years, 5 years, something like that. So it's solid by now.
Wow. And I have a couple more questions I usually ask everybody. I'm going to add a third question there. What's your preferred database?
My preferred database. Honestly, I use MySQL by choice because I know how it behaves. I know how to back it up correctly and so on and so forth. And recent versions are actually not that bad. But additionally, pretty much all the work that I end up doing is maintenance programming. I don't get to work on anything new for the past time of many, many years. And when you're a maintenance programmer, you basically deal with what you're, you know, it was you're dealt with. I worked with Microsoft SQL Server a lot. I worked a lot with Postgres as well. And I actually didn't like a lot of it because our DBD driver in Perl is not really good, but, you know, it is what it is, so free software and all that. But yeah, so these days I pretty much, most of the time I get to just work on whatever is there.
And your favorite text editor?
Oh, that's a bad one. My favorite text editor, I am very old school. I actually work in Midnight Commander, which is a clone of Norton Commander from back in the day, you know, from the DOS days. And Midnight Commander has a built-in editor, which is kind of like Nano, in a sense, but with syntax highlighting and other bells and whistles. But it's a simple, you know, cursor navigation editor. And I have been using this pretty much ever since I started working with Linux. So that's what I use. It's called CoolEdit or MCEdit. And yeah.
Okay, well, that was a new answer. Actually, I think I heard it like maybe twice before in the entire series of this show. And your favorite scripting language? I might be able to guess this.
My favorite scripting language? Yeah, I guess. Bash is a pretty good scripting language, but Perl is better.
Yes, finally.
No, look. Actually, you have to give it to Bash. There is no other language in which you can build pipelines with correct process control, you know, and pipe control as in Bash. There is no other, in everything else, Perl included, you have to do these objects, you have to keep track of them and stuff like that. In Bash, it's just blah pipe, and if something, you know, if something blows up, you just look at your exit value and you're done, and that's it. So there is space for everything.
Okay, and I have to do this just so people will laugh at home. Can you say must get moose and squirrel?
Must get moose and squirrel?
Yeah.
I wasn't sure I heard the right thing, but yeah.
That's good. Hey, Peter, thank you for coming on the show and telling us all about things that I only know a little bit about, strangely enough, because like I said, I'm not an expert in DivX class yet. I need to read all the rest of the tutorial documentation one more time. But thank you for coming on and talking to it for us about it for us.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Thank you. That was Peter Abbotson talking to us about DivX class and a bunch of other crazy Perl code. What do you think, Guillermo?
Well, I learned a lot. That is something I'm not actually used for a while, you know, actual database stuff in Perl. But I am actually interested in seeing that little wacky workaround he did. So let's say I might check that out and see how that actually works, how that's written down.
You mean the crazy weak references in both directions? When you destroy it flips the relationship?
Yeah.
I don't think you want to see that. I think it will make you permanently hate Perl, because the problem with Perl is it uses reference counting instead of tree walking, and so you have to do this sort of GC level stuff when you end up making circular references, and it sort of leaks into all the code. But I believe Perl 6 gets rid of all that, so maybe that'll solve some of the problems for us. So anyway, anything else before we wrap up the show here?
No, not really. I think I'm done.
Great. Okay. So so coming up next week, we have Caddy, which is a high-performance web server written in Go. I won't be hosting that show. I'm going to be out on a cruise ship celebrating my birthday somewhere along that week. My birthday is November 22nd. Same birthday exactly as Mariel Hemingway. She's my twin sister, but from different mothers. But same day, same exact day. So, and I even met her like a couple months ago, which is really nice. Following that, Konomo, which is a device that's powered by advanced JavaScript for the Internet of Things. So we have yet another hardware show. And I believe Aaron's coming back on that one to definitely host that one. Co-host, because I'll be the host on it. Pi Week, I don't know how to pronounce that, for web analytics. Tuleap, which is an application lifecycle management software. And Bridge Designer and Contest. My friend Steven Ressler, who has been on a few of the Insight Cruises, is a mechanical engineer, and he's going to talk about an application that you can have high school kids enter a contest about how to build a bridge for the least amount of money that has the greatest or the best strength. You can find out about all those people and others by going to the master page for this show, twitch.tv/floss. We have all the upcoming guests list there, including the ones I'm working on. I had opened up Q1, at least the dates. Now I just need to start sending email. I have about 10 emails in my to-do list that I'm going to start sending. And then those aren't even on the spreadsheet yet, but I've also got a bunch more on the spreadsheet that I'll have to repeat the email. It's amazing how many times I have to email somebody until they actually say, yes, I'll be on the show, even though they've already said, yes, I want to be on the show. Oh, well. That's just part of the overhead of doing this thing. We have a live stream. We took a question from there today. It's 8 a.m. Pacific time, Tuesdays at live.twit.tv. You can follow us at Floss Weekly on Google+ and at Floss Weekly on Twitter. You can follow me as Randall L. Schwartz on Google+ and as at Merlin on Twitter. And other than my cruise, I really have nothing to promote right now. I'm going to be in the Anaheim area the third week in January. I'm also going to Scale somewhere right around that. So if you're attending Scale in January, please come and see me and say hello. I'm hoping that I got my Dart talk accepted, but if not, I'll be there representing Floss Weekly. Yes, Floss Weekly. All right, that's all I want to plug. Anything you want to plug, Guillermo?
Well, I'll also be in Scale, so I'll be seeing you there again.
Okay.
And I guess that's it. People can follow me on Twitter, I guess. It's at GAMARAL. And if you're interested in some, you know, videos and stuff I do, you can just Google my name, Guillermo Amaral. You'll see me. I'm like the top result usually. I guess that's it.
All right. All right. Well, thank you, Guillermo, for co-hosting the show to make this another South of the Border show. Very awesome. Thanks.
Yeah, man. No problem. Anytime.
Very cool. And we'll see you all again next week. Well, most of us will see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.